We've come to a kind of milestone in our relationship this evening. This is the last of the monthly talks that I'll be giving. And just to reflect a little bit, we actually started this Thursday evening sitting group together in 1997. And for some time in the 1990s, I was coming here every other week, twice a month. And then I disappeared for a period in the late 90s and early part of this decade, living in various parts of the country, and including Silver City. And then we resumed our relationship, I think, around 2002, and I started coming here on a monthly basis and have been for these years. So the relationship is shifting. It will continue, but it's shifting. I will be coming in 2010. I'll be coming and offering a 2 4-week series. One series on one subject will be in March, and then there'll be a second series in the last Thursday of October and the first 3 Thursdays of November next year. It's a little poignant to me because what I've wanted to do with this community is to help provide a certain level of continuity for you. And I won't be able to do that any longer. And it's been a real pleasure for me to try to provide that level of continuity for you. What it comes down to finally is I really care about you. I really care about this community. You are one of my Dharma homes. You know, so I feel like I'm coming home when I come here. You know, I care about your welfare as much as I care about my own. And in fact, I can't tell the difference anymore between your welfare and mine. That distinction, that difference doesn't make sense to me anymore. So I just wanted to honor the fact that our relationship is shifting. And as I was thinking about this evening, you know, what do I want to talk about on this is the last time that I get to choose the subject. You know, I'll be choosing the subject for the 2 series, but once I've chosen that subject, I don't get to riff anymore. And I've really enjoyed riffing, although there's a downside to that. So it'll be more coherent in those 2 4-week series. So what would I choose for this last monthly talk? And I've really wanted to talk in some way about the teachings and the practice that's comprehensive. And I really want to talk, as I always do, I want to talk in such a way that whatever I share with you might actually be useful to you as you try to liberate yourself. I've listened to a number of Dharma talks recently, and they're by very well-known teachers for whom I have a lot of respect. But at the end of the talks, I've actually thought to myself, now what do I take away from this? And I couldn't think of anything. I've just listened recently to a very well-known and very respected teacher, and I felt I was listening into their highly developed stream of consciousness. You know, so it went here and it went there and went there, and it was really interesting to follow, but what could I take away and actually to apply in terms of liberating myself? And I actually couldn't find it. I hope there's going to be a takeaway this evening. I'm pretty clear about what it is, but the important thing is at the end of this talk, whether you're clear about some information that you can take away from here that you can actually use to liberate yourself. So just to step back and to talk about what feels like the essence of the teachings and the practice, and to really go from there. And I think it's really important. I gave a talk a few weeks ago in another town, and someone came up afterward and said, that was good, basic, but good. And I'm pretty sure that in that person's mind, the basic was a judgment, but for me, the basic is an affirmation. I hope that everything I say is basic. And so, you know, really the essence of what the Buddha was teaching was for us to find ways to increase happiness for ourselves and for others and for the world, and to decrease suffering for ourselves and for others and for the world. The Buddha said, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. Suffering and happiness. So it's really about that. And that's really, from my perspective, this is the most essential thing, the most central thing to us as living beings. So we can learn about all kinds of stuff. We can go out and learn new languages. We can learn about quantum physics, and we can learn about how to write computer programs, and we can learn about all kinds of things that could actually be really helpful to us in our lives and useful to us in our lives. But learning those things is not intrinsically going to lead to more happiness and less suffering. And so that's what I find so wonderful, and why I'm so happy doing the work that I'm doing, because I feel I'm constantly in my own life working the essence and constantly trying to encourage other people to work the essence. The essential, what is the essential information that we need in order to increase our happiness and to decrease our suffering? And this is about something universal to all living beings. All living beings, without exception, want to be happy, and they don't want to suffer. So how do we do it? How do we increase our happiness, and how do we decrease our suffering? And what I'd like to talk about tonight is the fact that we can actually make choices. That's going to be the takeaway. You can make choices. We can actually make choices in our lives that will lead to greater happiness and to less suffering. I think that there are more chairs out in the back. If you want to get some chairs, please. Oh, there are also chairs over here. You're welcome to come back over here. You know, the Buddha said that the thing that most distinguished humans from animals is the fact that humans have a capacity for more choice. But essentially, for the most part, not entirely, but excuse me, for the most part, animals' responses to their circumstances, to the events in their lives, to their experience, is so deeply conditioned that it's really hardwired and instinctual. They have to respond that way. Because of our large brains and our self-consciousness, we actually have a better chance of actually making choices in response to our experience. That doesn't mean that we do. I think we can see in our own lives, and we can certainly see in observing others, that there are ways in which if we just go on automatic pilot, and if we just act out of our habitual conditioning, we're not making choices. Somebody's angry at us, we either get scared and cower, or we get angry back. Is there a third choice? You know, there's that habitual response in response to someone's anger. You know, I could go down a whole list of things, how we can be almost as hardwired and almost as instinctual as animals, unless we actually choose to make choices. To step back and say, I could do this or I could do that. That simple thing is one of the things that distinguishes us as human beings. And that's the key to our freedom. That's the key to our liberation. That's the key to finding ways to really increase our happiness and to decrease the pain and suffering in our lives. Being able to make choices. Just for example, and Kempton talked just now about dana, this quality of generosity, which is really central to the teachings and to the practice in this particular tradition, is that we actually cultivate the capacity to be generous. And we can make the choice. You know, I made that choice just yesterday. And I was in a kind of situation where I could make a contribution, and I chose to be generous. And I think it's really important for us when we practice generosity is to remember to take care of our own needs as well. It's not about practicing generosity to the degree that you're actually sacrificing something. But to notice, does that quality of generosity bring us happiness? When we're generous, when we give in one way or another, does that bring happiness? You know, you can see for yourself. And does that quality of generosity bring happiness to others? And is it possible that that quality of generosity actually brings more happiness to the world? Just thinking about Bill Gates. I used to work in philanthropy. Actually, I did a lot of work as a funder for foundations, and also I did a lot of work as a fundraiser, raising money. And those of us in the philanthropic world kept watching Bill Gates, this was many years ago, saying, when is he ever going to be generous? This guy has more money than any other human being in the world. It's not true now, but it was then. And what's he going to do with it? And you know, the philanthropic world was pushing at him, saying, look, if you will just be an exemplar, if you make an example of yourself, it can really influence this whole new industry that's coming up, because basically the electronic industry was not very generous. And he said, just give me time to make my money, and then I'm going to give it away. And we said, yeah. Well, you know, he's not working for Microsoft anymore, and he's devoting his time to being generous with the money that he earned. He was as good as his word. And I bet that brings him happiness. Mm-hmm. You know, I bet actually it gives him more happiness to give that money away than the happiness he got in making the money. That was just one example. And think of the happiness that he is giving, he and Melinda and his father, Bill Sr., and all the rest of the people involved in the Gates Foundation, and Warren Buffett, who dumped billions into the Gates Foundation. Think of the way that they are relieving suffering in the world and bringing happiness to beings. It's just one little example. It's not a little example, one big example. You know, it makes us happy to be generous. It increases happiness and it reduces suffering, and we can make that choice. But we have to make the choice. You know, if we are deeply habituated to respond with fear around our material circumstances, we're not going to be generous. We have to work with the fear. We can make the choice. We really have the power to choose in terms of ethical conduct. You know, one of the major aspects of our spiritual path. We can choose to speak and act in ways that bring happiness to ourselves and to others, and we can choose to speak and act in ways that reduce suffering in the world. Or we can choose the other. We can choose to speak and act in ways that bring more suffering to ourselves, more suffering to others, and more suffering to the world. And it may be at some point in our lives when we weren't really aware of ethical conduct, when that wasn't part of the teaching, not part of the conditioning that we have had in our lives, it may be that we just reacted out of habit in how we spoke and how we acted. I grew up in a family where there was a lot of violence. And I'm not sure why I made the choice. When I was a small child, growing up in an environment where violence was pretty much universal, I decided I'm not going to be that way. whatever it takes, I'm not going to do that. And I'm so glad for having made that choice. I really have increased my own happiness, and I've increased the happiness in the world by choosing not to be physically violent. And I like it. I like not being violent, you know? There's happiness. Do you see? This is not an abstract idea about increasing happiness and reducing suffering. It's very much about how we act. You know, I made a commitment years and years ago that I would not consciously kill another living being. And so I don't swat mosquitoes and, you know, I don't kill. And actually there's a wonderful kind of happiness in that. There's some kind of joy that comes from having this amazing sense of being connected to all of life and respecting all of life, honoring all of life. And when I've mistakenly killed, not intentionally, but when I've vacuumed up a spider, I feel immense remorse. So sorry to have done it. There's pain. There's definitely pain involved in seeing the suffering of another being. You know, and certainly this is true of our speech. It's certainly important in terms of our sexual expression, the way we express our sexuality in our lives. See if it's possible to stay connected. Most of us really know this whole rap. I don't have to do the whole rap with you. But the important thing is, and it really takes a kind of vigilance, is that we actually have to find that moment of choice. You know, it's like this point on which so much pivots, that moment of choice. You know, am I going to respond? I actually heard a wonderful example today of someone who was being screamed at over the phone by somebody who was really angry, who chose not to respond in kind, and who was just very simple and friendly and connected and followed up with kindness. You know, it may not seem such a big deal, but do you know how rare that is in the world? To have that kind of restraint, to choose to be kind when someone is screaming invective at you. It's not such an easy choice to make, but it is a choice that can be made. So being clear about whether or not we choose to be physically violent, being clear about whether or not we steal or take what isn't freely given, and really taking that to subtle levels. You know, how do we use the world's resources? What kind of carbon footprint are we going to have? It's not about getting over moralistic about it. It's just being conscious and deciding what kind of choices am I going to make. You know, I've chosen to do less plane travel, a lot less plane travel, for obvious what is now obvious reasons. 5 years ago, it wouldn't have been so obvious. Making the choice about our sexual expression, making the choice about our use of communication, of words, making choices about our use of intoxicants in terms of whether or not the use of intoxicants might lead to more happiness or more suffering. Making that choice. And I think that we're empowered to do that. You can choose these things, and it does make a difference. It makes a difference for you, and it makes a difference for others. It's just, are we willing to make the choice? And then the choice, you know, making the choice of purifying our minds through meditation, making the choice of developing deep awareness or mindfulness, of really being very alert in the world so that we pick up what's happening on deeper and deeper and more subtle levels, being able to tell what's really going on here. Or the purification that comes from cultivating deep concentration in our lives, deep calm, and the rapture and the bliss that comes with deep concentration. that purification, making that choice, and we are empowered to do that now that we know that. Yes. What do you need?
Can I take a picture?
Sure. Are you okay for having a picture taken for the temple? Okay. Please feel free to do it. Say Buddha.
Okay, cool.
Okay.
I think that was a good choice.
Thank you. So we can make that choice, but we have to make that choice. You know, carving out the time to do meditation practice. It's at some point it becomes so obvious that there are vast benefits for doing meditation that you just can't. There's no longer a choice. But at some point, it is a choice that we make about whether or not we have a regular meditation practice, about whether or not we go to retreats. There is an enormous benefit that happens, and there are forms of happiness that were inconceivable to us at other times in our lives that can come from doing meditation. The amazing happiness of a tranquil mind that isn't anxious. The amazing happiness of bliss, the amazing happiness of rapture or joy that comes from that purification. Making that choice has vast implications that we can't even understand in terms of benefiting ourselves, but also benefiting the world. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh had way back when there were the Vietnamese boat people who were trying to escape Vietnam in the 1970s, Thich Nhat Hanh, who's Vietnamese and was suffering terribly over the suffering of his people because so many of those boat people were killed at sea trying to get out, he said, it was just a really beautiful metaphor, and many of you, I think, know this metaphor. If you're in a really crowded boat and you're in a storm, it only takes one person who is calm and stable to calm everyone else. Just one person who's able to hold a certain kind of stability, and that can save the whole boat. You know, that's what we can do. It's not just about ourselves getting calm. It's about the amazing impact around us. And I think probably you can think of times in your own life when you have been the steady center for an agitated group of people. So the making the choice of doing meditation practice, and then finally making the choice of developing wisdom, of understanding what is true and what is not, and the extraordinary benefits of that. The deepest happiness comes from wisdom. We're making the choice, you know, of essentially generating loving kindness and compassion toward yourself and toward all beings. You know, these are such easy words to speak, but the actual happiness that comes from kindness is amazing. And the way it comes back to us. Twice in the last week, I've done some spiritual counseling with people who are very troubled. And they've said to me, I am so isolated. What can I do? You know, I'm very isolated in my life. I don't have friends. And essentially, I said, what I'm going to say to you is simple-minded. But if you are loving, you'll get love back. That's how the karma works. If you generate love toward others, eventually you will be surrounded by love. You know, it'll be all around you. That's the karmic effect of being loving. It makes us happy to love. It makes us happy to have the love returning to us. It's a form of happiness that really reduces suffering. It's an extraordinarily potent form of happiness, but we have to choose to do it. I mean, this is all so simple and basic. You've heard it all before. since this is the last talk, I just want to say, the last monthly talk, I just want to say, you can choose. You can choose that for your life. You don't have to feel isolated. None of us is ever alone because there isn't any self. You know, there's nobody to be alone, really. Once you know that, it all gets really easy. And that's what wisdom does. That's the deepest kind of happiness that wisdom brings us, is when you understand there's no separation. There's no isolation. There's no aloneness. It's just a total myth. The reducing of suffering and the increase of happiness by making those choices. And I just want to say, just those are the choices, the obvious choices, that for those of us who have been involved in the Dharma for a long time, this is an old story. You know, be ethical, do your meditation practice, be kind, be loving, be compassionate, be empathetic, get wise. Making all of those choices, you know, very familiar. But I also want to say that there are other choices that we can make in our lives that I think that are really important. And I want to say that to me, it feels to me very important for us to make choices about association. With whom do we choose to associate? You know, people feel victimized by other people. When you feel victimized, you feel helpless. And when you're helpless, it means that you've lost your choices. And there are many, many circumstances, certainly, in this world where people are trapped in associations. You know, if you have an utterly sadistic father and you're 5 years old, can't get out. Now, I'm just using an extreme example here. So there are places where people don't have choices. But we adults can choose. And I think that asking the question about every association in our lives, in terms of our intimate relationships, in terms of our friendships, in terms of our communities, in terms of the organizations that we belong to, in terms of all of our forms of association, is to ask, is this relationship likely to lead to more happiness or more suffering? You know, making lots of space for the fact that we are all weird and neurotic and we got lots of toxins in our minds and hearts, and we're going to get bumpy even in the best of relationships. It gets bumpy. You know, really taking into all that into account, but really in the sense of evaluation, is this a wholesome relationship? Is it going to lead to more happiness for me, if it's an individual with this other person? Or is it likely to lead to more suffering? And then making that choice. Years ago, someone came to we're not calling them interviews now. I have to keep remember a practice meeting. Someone came to a practice meeting. Someone I had never met before, and said to me, "I've been in a secret relationship for 15 years and my spouse doesn't know about it and the other person's spouse doesn't know about it. What do you think?" and I said, "Okay, you're trusting me enough to come to a total stranger and to share this information. The only reason you would come is because you're feeling some discomfort." "Yes, I feel discomfort over the amount of deception involved." And then I just asked one question. I said, what choice would lead to more happiness and what choice would lead to more suffering? You know, can we consider this question? You know, and they said, "I already know that. I need to end the relationship. I just need support to do it." You know, or I also did some spiritual counseling with someone who said, "I'm getting more and more into S&M. And there's something about it that is just very exciting to me, and can you help me with it?" And I just asked the same question. You know, in this sadomasochistic stuff, what's more likely to lead to happiness and what's more likely to lead to suffering. And there's no moral judgment in that. It's just making a choice and saying to someone, you can choose. You know, saying to addicts, as hard as it is, you can choose. And even if we're in certain kinds of relationships, especially relationships with institutions, where we're not allowed very much choice, there's still a choice that we can make. And again, I'm going to use an extreme example. But if you were born an African American in the 17th, 18th, or early 19th century in certain parts of the United States, at one point in any part of the United States, you were most likely to be born a slave. Now, that was a tough institution. I've been reading quite a lot about slavery recently, the slavery in this country. So there aren't many choices. You weren't allowed to be educated. You know, every aspect, external aspect of your life, whether or not you could mate with someone, whether or not you could be with your loved ones, because people got sold away all the time. You know, the circumstances of slaves' lives were very, very limited in terms of choices. But there's one thing that no institution can control, and that is our attitude toward our circumstances. No one can control our basic attitude or our internal response to our circumstances. And so it's actually possible to be a slave and to be internally absolutely free, because you are not controlled by the institution. I'm using a very extreme example here, but you and I have to relate to the IRS, you know? And on some level, we have to relate to a federal government, to a state government, to county governments, to city government. We have to relate to bureaucracies. We have to relate to a whole bunch of laws. And in many ways, that constrains us. It limits our choices. But I think in the midst of that, we can still choose what is likely to lead to more happiness, what is likely to lead to more suffering. And I'm not saying that the answers are easy. Sometimes they're very, very difficult. The reason I mention the IRS is that a number of my friends are tax resisters. They refuse to pay for war. And I've watched the immense sacrifice that they've made in their lives. They are choosing something that to them brings more happiness and less suffering, even though it's a very, very hard choice. And I had to make a really hard choice many years ago, because these are a number of my very closest friends. I had to make a choice a number of years ago, even though I absolutely support their position, because I deal with two emotional illnesses, severe depression and pretty severe post-traumatic stress disorder. I can't deal with the stress of being a tax resister. I can't do it. So I had to make the choice to pay my taxes. Now, your politics may be different from mine, so I'm not trying to impose my political values on you, but I'm just giving you an example. You know, in the case of relating to the IRS, I said, got to do it. You know, I got to play it their way, just because I didn't have enough emotional stability to do it the other way. And it was the right choice. It allowed me to do what I'm doing here this evening. So really, even in those circumstances where we feel as if our choices are profoundly constrained, we can still choose for greater happiness and less suffering. And if I may, I'd like to just mention one other example. There are social oppressions in our society that cause massive, unbelievable suffering. And we all know about them. You know, racism and sexism and heterosexism and ableism. You know the list. And essentially what these oppressions do is they exclude the target group from participation in important activities in our society. They exclude people from the resources of our society, and they also exclude people from political power in our society. And those are very, very powerful forces in our society. And they do constrain us in many ways. You know, I'm a gay man, and I have yet to see a gay president or a gay senator or a gay cabinet officer, an out gay or gay Supreme Court justice or an out gay governor. And I can go through the whole list. It doesn't exist. It hasn't yet existed. And so we're excluded from the institutions of society. You know, we're not allowed to serve in the military unless we're closeted. We can't get married in most places. You know the story. So whatever the oppression is, if you are a member of the target group, if you're a woman, if you're a person of color, if you're gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender, if you have a disability, if you are working class, if you're poor, there are ways in which your choices are limited, and yet you can still make choices that lead to greater happiness. And I just want to give one little example. We do a canoe retreat every year, a Vipassana canoe retreat, and it's a really wonderful thing. And one of my friends came on the retreat this year, someone I know pretty well, who turned out to be the only person of color in the canoe retreat. I don't consider myself white. I'm actually mixed race, but I'm taken for white, and so I didn't count in terms of her discomfort. And at some point, about 3 days into the retreat, we were, you know, way off in the wilderness, she said to the group, "I feel uncomfortable as the only person of color here." And we had a really, as a group, as a community, as a sangha, we had a really, really valuable conversation. And then this person and I also had a really rich conversation. And it really, our conversation helped to clarify something for me. And I spoke to her, you know, privately, I spoke to her as a gay man, to a person of color. And I said, you know, even if the dominant group does not consider us equal, we can make the choice to walk right into the middle of the dominant group and be equal. Does that make sense? Yep. And I said, and then their power's gone. It was a formulation that took me a long time to get to, but it actually has been really useful for me as a member of a target group of social oppression. I have a lot more happiness now because I feel like I have more choice. I can go right into the middle of homophobes as a gay man and be equal, whether they consider me equal or not. It's just a really useful way, just one possible way of looking at it, because now that I understand that, not only do I have more happiness, but I'm empowered in a certain kind of way. So even in those places where we're really constrained, you know, essentially what that formulation is about walking into the middle of the oppressive group or the oppressor group and being equal. What that does, what it means is a transformation of our consciousness. We're not a victim anymore, and we're essentially not internally constrained anymore. And I thought it was just really, really wonderful a little over a year ago when for the first time a woman was a serious candidate for the presidency. A woman who walked into the boys' club and acted equal, no matter what they thought of her. And a black man running for the presidency, a person of color, who walked into the middle of white society and acted equal, no matter what they thought of him. You know, on some level, being free from the oppression. So making choices. And so the takeaway from all this the takeaway from the, from all this is that you can choose. And I think that there are so many times when we're in circumstances in our lives where we feel like we don't have choices, we're stuck. And then to really ask, do I have a choice here? Is there a choice that I could make that will lead to more happiness and less suffering? You know, it can be in the formal aspects of our practice of generosity and ethical conduct and meditation and wisdom, but it can also be in other aspects of our lives of how do we relate in our relationships. You know, I've let go of some good friendships in the last few years because I've realized this is not leading to much happiness for myself and the other person. We're just too divergent in terms of our values and our capacity to show up. You know, to show up in the sense of taking responsibility for our own minds of heart and hearts, taking responsibility for our responses instead of projecting everything out. I realize, oh, this is not going to really work. Let it go. And then actively choosing relationships in my life where there is that reciprocity, where both people are working at it, where both people are showing up on the deepest level, and the kind of wonderful happiness that comes for that. From that. And then also for me it's really useful. You know, when I when I'm feeling victimized by my health insurance company, for example. You can't imagine that that would happen, but it does occasionally. You know, is there a way working with this big institution that I can still make choices and be empowered in this situation? And it's wonderful when we get creative about it. You know, it doesn't mean the institution goes away. It doesn't even mean that the institution changes, but our response to it, our attitude toward it, can really change the way we connect to that institution. So, thank you for your patience. Any comments or questions about anybody unclear about what the takeaway is? Please, yeah.
Thank you for speaking. It was just a lot of, even not to say basic points again, but a lot of great points. Something that's on my mind with the recent political action or decision to raise the troop level in Afghanistan, speaking of war, using your question, will this bring more happiness or more suffering? Thinking of the decision Obama made, I know this is perhaps not a directly answerable question, but how do you apply that question to that situation, such as, will this bring about more suffering for us or for them if we would pull out, rather than the happiness of sending troops over? Just applying your question to that sort of situation, though I know it's a tough one.
Yeah, as you say, there's no easy answer to that. You know, I think that people can argue both sides. You know, this choice will lead to more happiness. This choice will lead to more happiness. I can only tell you my response. And my response comes from the Buddha, who said, hatred has never ended by hatred. Hatred can only end by love. And I will not support war, period. Even if my life depends on it. I will not support war. And so I don't support the decision. I don't support the war in Afghanistan. And I know you can make certainly wonderful, reasonable arguments for the fact that the war is necessary and the next war will be necessary and the war after that will be necessary. It's always necessary. And I think it's going to take a decision. Actually, Dwight Eisenhower said, you know, he said, we're going to have war, and this is a guy who, you know, ran the biggest war we've ever had. He was a 5-star general in the Second World War. Dwight Eisenhower said, we're going to have war until the peoples of the world stand up and say, we won't do it anymore. And this was a guy who really knew what war meant. He was in the First World War, and he was the supreme Allied commander in the Second World War. He knew what war meant, and he knew what the costs were. So, you know, from my perspective, I don't care what the consequences are. War has to end. So, but that's, you know, I feel that ultimately that's going to lead to more happiness. We have to find a different way to work out our conflicts. So, and I understand there's lots of arguments that can be made against that position as Pine. Does that help at all?
It sure does. It's just interesting to think about bringing about more suffering and more happiness, and how that applies to recent decisions or pertinent examples, prevalent things in our world today.
Right.
So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. And what I would suggest, you know, just in terms of making that decision, is look back at least to the beginning of the period of European imperialism and what happened through the age of imperialism, what happened to the subject people in the age of imperialism, and what the results of that have been and the impact on the world. You know, and especially the world of Afghanistan and all of the Middle East. You know, before you make the decision about what will lead to more happiness and what will lead to more suffering, know the whole history. It's not about some decision that has to be made at this point. We really have to see the whole unfolding of it and the likely unfolding if our country acts as an imperial power. You know, and again, I don't want to impose my own political values on you at all, but that's my perspective. You got to take the long view in terms of making that decision. Thank you. Please.
Well, I was just going to bring that back to a sort of personal level. I mean, sometimes the choice is what's going to bring more happiness or what's going to bring more suffering is not all that clear.
Right.
And you might have like several different choices, and you know, it's not so obvious which path, which choice to make. So what do you do?
You know, I think that, my response is not a cop out, at least from my perspective. But essentially, what I was just suggesting. Okay, the president has made a decision, and actually, I just came out of retreat yesterday, so I did not hear the speech. I only heard the results. So I'm a little bit out of the loop on this subject, because I was sitting in a retreat incommunicado. So, but essentially, what I was suggesting just now about this choice in the war in Afghanistan is that essentially we have to understand on a subtler and subtler level all of the conditions. So we might be able to see the surface conditions, but then to really understand the subtler conditions.
Yeah, and my experience is that sometimes the surface condition seems like obvious, but then if you just sit with it a moment, it all shifts.
Yeah.
You know, another few moments and all shifts again. And then pretty soon you're just kind of like, okay, there's like all these different perspectives. And
right. So it's the one of the seven factors of enlightenment, the seven qualities that free us, is the factor of inquiry and investigation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really asking, what's really going on here? What's going on here? What really is going on here? Mm-hmm. And I think if we're really willing to bring all of our faculties to bear, yes, it gets very complicated and gets very ambiguous, but very often a pattern will appear.
Okay.
You know, and then you're able to make the choice.
So the clarity will come if you just sit with it long enough without reacting. So sometimes it's kind of like, you know, you think this is the right, will bring more happiness, but then you later discover, oh, that was just an impulsive.
Yeah, it's true. And what I've come to trust, and this is not something that we normally think of when we're making important choices in our lives, but what I've come to trust is, okay, there's a rational process. You gather information and you analyze the information, you weigh this and you weigh that, all of which is really important. But as you do this practice, actually, it's called insight meditation. And that moment of insight is an intuitive knowing. And if you do enough insight meditation, if there are enough insights that happened, that intuitive faculty becomes very powerful. And more, it's not so much about figuring it out. It's about intuitively knowing what the right choice is. And that doesn't mean we always make the right choice from intuition. But as that faculty actually becomes more powerful and more subtle in its workings, I've come to trust it more and more. You know, I am making better choices in my life.
Okay.
And most of it comes from the intuitive understanding. So, you know, trust your intuition as well as your head.
Right.
So, yeah, please.
I'm glad this topic came up already. I mean, that you're touching on it. And I was totally with you about 2 days ago. And then someone mentioned, well, it's Taliban and all of that. And I remember when this thing first started way back then, I thought, Taliban, first of all, weren't they the ones who blew up that great big statue of Buddha that was existing there? Number one. And number two, the women's rights was atrocious. Some of the worst on the planet. It was horrible. And I thought, well, if there's anything moral for the United States to get involved, this is it. It's a whole lot better than going after somebody's oil. And I thought along those lines. And I find out that, you know, as this thing progresses and stuff, one thing that really disturbs me, that's not on the agenda at all, in the news media and stuff about the women of Afghanistan. Yeah. And I thought, gee, it'd be a trip to really find out what the women of Afghanistan really think. You know, do they want to go back into the holds and do all of that stuff?
I agree with everything you're saying. And I just want to say, is it possible to apply the Buddha's, this wonderful principle of the Buddha, hatred has never ceased by hatred, it can only cease by love. And is it possible to take that radical principle and apply it to the Taliban and the situation in Afghanistan? And you may decide that war is not the best way to work it out. And one of the things you have to do in order for love to work in terms of dissolving hatred is you actually have to understand people. You know, so the Taliban have acted in really destructive ways. Why did they do that? You know, and why are they so angry? And what's the history there? And what's their reality? What's the reality of the Taliban? So we have this name, Taliban, and a big red light goes on, and they have done a lot of destructive things, but they're human beings with histories. And to understand the Taliban as well as you understand your best friend, and then decide what's right. Just one thought. So, and last question, because we're running over, please.
Well, it's, I fear I'm just going to add to the consternation about the difficulties inherent in certain levels of decision making.
Right.
So, for instance, I'm not sure of the particulars about this, but the Gates Foundation has funded agricultural projects which increase food supply, a benefit, but on the other hand, the projects may have the long-term effect of being deleterious to the environment, to the, you know, the earth that produces the food, such that there may be a long-term limitation. And I guess there are choices that can be kind of paralyzing because one doesn't have the wherewithal really to make the best decision because of lack of information, or sometimes a generosity has been extended. For instance, we have these water bottles, these small, and yet we are generating, you know, something destructive in the disposal of these.
Yeah, I don't normally use these in my life, actually, for that very reason. And yes, we are going to blow it over and over and over again. But I think that if our essential intention is to be aware, which is to be aware of all the conditions that we can find, to be aware and to be kind, and to apply those two principles universally, so you go to the Gates Foundation and say, thanks so much, but have you noticed the long-term effects of this agriculture? And they might say, thank you for pointing that out. You know, they're not a total huge institution that can't be affected.
So intentionality
is having the wholesome intention and then doing the best you can with the understanding that sometimes you're not going to do it so well. But I think all the choices that I was describing, you know, are choices that I've tried to make in my own life, and I can tell you my life is so much happier than it used to be. You know, internally and externally in my relationships, and I do blow it, you know. I say things that are harmful to people, and I do things that are harmful to people, and I make the wrong choices because I didn't have enough information, I wasn't conscious enough. But the general direction of this life is moving toward more happiness and less suffering, just because I'm really trying to make those choices as well as I can. So not to get paralyzed by the complexity of the situation. You know, the cashier at the checkout counter in the supermarket, are you going to be kind or are you going to be shut down? Start there, you know. And then take on the more complex things. But, you know, start with the very basics in your life and see, is it possible to make wholesome choices? So, friends, thank you for your patience. And there are some, just a few announcements. And I just want to say I've loved working with you over these years. Thank you.